This episode of Stories of Value is brought to you by Barrowman Baker, LLC. With over two decades of experience, Barrowman Baker is here to help firms meet their business valuation staffing needs and to help individuals find that next opportunity. A nationally recognized leader in BV recruitment, Barrowman Baker, LLC. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Stories of Value, ASA's podcast looking at the human side of the appraisal profession. And I am thrilled to be joined today by Chris Mercer. Chris has been a member of ASA since 1987. He is a fellow accredited senior appraiser, so the best of the absolute best that we have within ASA. Chris, as many of you know, is a business valuation professional, and his focus lately has been looking at ways to apply corporate finance principles to private companies, trying to bring more rigor, more discipline, and a little more nuance to how they do business, kind of taking the lessons learned from the public sector, the public company area, over to the private company area. We're going to cover a lot of ground today. Chris, thank you so much for making the time to sit down with me.
Glad to be here, John.
So it's interesting because on the surface, for a lot of people, you'd say, well, you know, public company, private company, well, the differences are obvious. One's exchange traded, the other has, you know, private equity investors. And but when you start getting into the weeds of how they view their own economics, their own financial instruments, the vehicles they have for growth and for change, there's not as much kind of, I don't want to say rigor in a bad way, but they're not maybe as open-minded or forward-thinking in the private company sector. And you're trying to bring the lessons learned from the public over to the private.
We're trying to bring the discipline of corporate finance over to the private company sector, where corporate finance is something that's not often thought about. I'm reminded of a story. I was called by an analyst a number of years ago, and they said that this client, Norm, wanted to talk to me. He was frustrated. And I got on the phone and I said, what's going on? He said, come down and see me. And I said, okay, I'll come down and see you. Went down to see him, and I found out that he had attempted to buy a bass boat, $25,000. And Norm was a rich man, very successful, $200 million business, and he didn't have enough cash to buy a small bass boat one weekend and had to borrow the money. His wife was upset greatly at him, because they didn't have any liquid resources outside the company. So I talked to Norm, and I said, Norm, we got to do a couple of things. You're going to have to hire a chief operating officer. You're going to convert to an S corporation, because you've been needing to do that for many years. And we're going to do a leveraged recapitalization of your business to take money out. That you're going to get $10 million out of the company. We'll go to the bank and borrow it. $10 million after taxes, so that your wife won't know that if something happens to you, that she will not be subject to the uncertainty of her children running the company. So we did just that over a period of time. We hired a COO. We got the board of directors working. We did a leverage recapitalization. We're able to arrange the financing so that he had no recourse. It was just the company's financing. And what we found is that he was a happier man. The COO began doing the kinds of things that a COO typically does, and the board of directors began to function. So all of this increased the returns to the other shareholders, got liquidity for Norm and his wife, and actually made for a better run company. And all we were doing is taking basic valuation principles and applying them not to determine a number, a value number, but to use those valuation principles to get returns for the shareholders on an active and current basis.
So you said something interesting, and I'm going to unpack the story a little bit, because you talk about the liquidity problem. When you're looking at private companies, you know, a lot of these folks, it's a life's passion, it's a life's work. And you hear oftentimes that, to your point, the business can be worth millions, tens if not hundreds, but the owners themselves, the founders, not a lot of liquidity there. I mean, how often or how common is it that you walk into a situation and you find somebody who's a wildly successful business person, but because it's all invested in the business and they haven't thought kind of next level on How can I get liquidity out, or how can I put myself on more firm footing? Do you find people with these liquidity issues? And what are those conversations like to say, hey, there's a better way to go about this?
What I tell people, well, first off, it's a very common situation that the owner of a closely held business, a family business or a private business, has 80, 90% or more of his or her wealth tied up in that company. And one of the basic principles of investment is diversification. So what I suggest to people is that we use the company as a vehicle to provide liquidity and diversification opportunities for their shareholders. Another example, I received a call from the chairman of a very successful company. He was going to a board meeting, and he wanted me, I actually flew to his location, had breakfast with him for 3 hours, where we talked about the basic idea of liquidity for shareholders. So the upshot of that was that he owned enough of the company that we recommended $100 million combination purchase and dividend, and he ended up with enough liquidity to provide a reasonable comfort for his family if anything should happen to the company. But once again, that's a matter of looking at the company, looking at the capability of the company and its balance sheet and the management of the company, and seeing if they can handle that kind of leverage. So that's a much better way to diversify than perhaps an acquisition, which is full of risk. The acquisition compounds the concentration, whereas a good distribution policy or a good leveraged dividend or a leveraged repurchase will provide liquidity for selected shareholders or for all the shareholders.
So you mentioned the concept, and I think this is what you're doing a lot today, is you're not necessarily going in and saying, well, the company's worth X, but you know what makes things valuable. You know, when you spend a lifetime valuing companies, you get a feel for the practices that drive value and the practices that erode value. And to me, what it sounds like is you're taking the best practices, the best principles that you've seen, and kind of reverse engineering it. Rather than coming in and saying it's worth this, it's, well, I know if you do this and this and this, not only can you be on a better footing from a liquidity, a personal liquidity standpoint, but you're going to, at the end of the day, have a more valuable company.
Every private company has a board of directors. Not every private company has a functioning board of directors. But it's incumbent upon the boards of directors of companies to evaluate management and to determine whether or not they are achieving reasonable returns for the shareholders. So one of the things we like to look at is return on invested capital. If I'm going to make an acquisition, for example, make an investment in new plant and equipment, the question is, will the return on invested capital enhance value, or if the return is inadequate, will it decrease value? What we know in many private companies is they have a habit of accumulating excess liquidity inside the company. What that does is two things. It lowers the rate of return to all shareholders, because it defers the ultimate payment of dividend. It lowers returns. It sometimes makes management lazy because they have that comfortable cushion of
They've
cash.
Got this large pile of cash, yes. So of course everything must be okay.
Everything must be okay, but bad returns, not reinvesting properly, and so the future value of the business is diminished as a result of that. What I tell a number of business owners is that your business is worth $10 million or some number. Your business plan, where you keep accumulating cash in the business, makes it worth $7 million because you're not distributing to your shareholders the cash that the company is generating, and you're not reinvesting appropriately in productive assets to grow the business. So it's I think corporate finance is an excellent tool that business appraisers can use to talk to business owners about their businesses.
So when you, so let's say you have the conversation with the board of directors, you know, and maybe it's at the behest of the owner, maybe the board's reached out and they said, okay, look, you know, we're trying to, you know, grow the value of this business or figure out, you know, what the long-term tenability looks like, or whatever the case may be. What's the receptiveness when you come in and you have these conversations? Do you find people are generally receptive to taking corporate finance principles that you know, yeah, can include things like leverage, which most private company owners, especially when it's, you know, that passion, that individual person with the passion who started it, you're telling them, hey, I'm going to ask you to take leverage on in your company when they've been sitting on the comfortable pile of cash all this time. What are the conversations like as you try to educate them around doing things differently?
Well, one of the things that we've done in recent years is to spend time writing and speaking about these issues. Several years ago, I wrote a book called Unlocking Private Company Wealth, and that's a business valuation-oriented book, but it deals with applied corporate finance for private companies, leverage recapitalizations, leverage dividends, you know, that sort of thing. All of the kinds of things that companies can do. We write about buy-sell agreements and the need for companies to have effective buy-sell agreements and valuations for those buy-sell agreements. Those, I guess, the writing about buy-sell agreements, the writing about unlocking private company wealth, and now Travis Arms at our company is a family business director blog, and he's writing every week to family business directors. And he's talking about corporate finance principles. He's talking about rates of return. He's talking about the very kinds of things you and I have just been talking mm-hmm. about, but in a much more disciplined way. What we find is that when people have read a little bit about it, they're much more receptive to a conversation with us than if I walk in off the street and say, hey, you know, you really need to do things differently.
So by starting the conversation proactively, people are coming to you and saying, hey, I've read about it. I want to learn more. I want to apply the principles.
Yes.
So so you've got these companies. You hit on something with the cash. I want to unpack for a minute. They're comfortable, right? They have the big pile of cash, the Scrooge McDuck. You know, I'm sitting in the vault on the big pile of cash and I'm comfortable. Do you find that when they're comfortable, that tends to be an impediment to change in these companies? Is it sort of a limiting factor for them to view the world differently?
I think, John, that we need in business an element of what I would call productive discomfort. When businesses are comfortable, the minute that you decide that you're comfortable, you sort of begin to decline. Because you're declining in terms of rate of return initially, you're declining in terms of initiative to grow, and that sort of thing. So I think that the idea of either with discipline reinvesting in the business, or if you don't have productive and reinvestment opportunities to pay dividends to the shareholders, is a good one, and it creates discipline for boards of directors of private companies, which is, there's more discipline in the public market than there is in the private market. So we're trying to bring some of that discipline that we observe in the public markets over to the private markets.
And it's, I guess it's hard to some degree, because in public, you know, it's kind of inherent in how those companies are run, and there's more direct responsibility to shareholders. In private, it's kind of a learned behavior to some degree with board and with management to kind of understand, you know, I need to have in my head, like, I've got this whole pile of shareholders over here who, if I don't get it right, are going to be really unhappy with me.
The idea, you've mentioned something very important here. Every private company has shareholders, maybe only one, but most private companies have multiple shareholders. People who run private companies sometimes tend to think seem to forget that their minority shareholders represent the capital that's allowing them to run the company. And so it's important for management and boards of directors to focus on the rate of return for all shareholders in order to run the company productively, because there's massive capital invested in private companies. And in many cases, the returns to minority shareholders are not very good.
So let's talk about that for a moment, though, because you would think if I'm a minority shareholder, I guess I'm comfortable or I'm okay with whatever the return is. Otherwise, you would expect them to agitate more. What's that dynamic like? You know, because I would expect, even though it's a private company and maybe a smaller pool of shareholders, at the end of the day, if they're not getting the returns, you'd expect them to voice that. But it seems like maybe they're not putting that pressure back on ownership and management.
Well, agitation as a minority shareholder in a private company is not an easy thing. So it's not like in the public market, I can agitate in a number of ways. I can agitate publicly. I can sell my stock and hopefully drive the price down to make management change the way they're doing things. In a private company, you don't have that option for control. And that's one of the reasons why one of the biggest discounts in valuation is the marketability discount. The marketability discount reflects that often lack of cash flow to minority investors and the lack of a good reinvestment policy going forward on the part of the controlling shareholders. The marketability discount is not some magic discount. It's a result of less cash flow, greater risk, and lower growth opportunities relative to the business itself. That's why I said earlier that the value of a business may be worth more than the value of a business plan. And what many controlling shareholders don't understand is that when they do these things that minimize returns to shareholders, they are affecting themselves and their future net worth as much as they are, maybe almost as much as the minority shareholders.
Yeah. And you said a great line, I'm going to steal forever and henceforth, which is productive discomfort, which is another way of framing risk. And to some degree, that business plan seems to be reflective of risk aversion or an aversion to productive discomfort. How focused do people become on the downside risk? You know, okay, you want me, I'm going to take on leverage, I'm going to apply these more, you know, disciplined principles, but there has to be risk there because there's risk in public companies when they apply these principles. And to them, they're probably viewing themselves as being the smaller fish in the pond applying the principles. What are they asking around risk, around that discomfort? You know, how do you get them comfortable with discomfort?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things that you do is talk about it and talk about the financial impact on all of the shareholders of, say, a total lack of leverage. I'm not one of these guys that wants private companies to go out and lever up to the hilt, but it is useful in many cases for private companies to have some debt. And if there's not a reason to have debt in terms of growing the business, maybe you can have debt and take money out of the business in the leveraged recapitalization or the leveraged dividend that I mentioned earlier. Because then the company can service that debt, generate a good ongoing return as that debt is paid down to the shareholders, and then a private company can do it again. And, you know, we're working with companies that have done this sort of thing two or three times over a period of years where they create liquidity outside the company. And what people don't recognize is that they say, I don't want the risk of taking the leverage on the company, but they have the risk of the company anyway. That risk, bad things happen to good companies, and it's always a good idea to have some eggs in another basket. Now, I've heard business owners say, I'm going to keep my eggs in this basket, and I'm going to watch that basket. Well, that's good, but like I say, bad things happen to good companies, and it may be a competitor, it may be a customer concentration issue, it may be a key management issue, it may be a supplier issue. but there are risks in the company. You want to run the company to work to minimize those risks, but also and increase value, but also to, like I say, generate returns to the shareholders outside of the company, and you do that by paying dividends. So I'm focused on talking about dividend policy for private companies. Some companies say, I ask the question every time I talk to a business owner, what's your dividend policy? Many times I've had an owner say, we don't have a dividend policy. And I say, yes, you do have a dividend policy. The non-payment of dividends
is a policy.
So the question is that a good policy for your company and for your shareholders? And at least that allows us to begin to have the conversation.
So is there a stage at which, you know, because private companies, like all companies, you know, there's a life cycle there, you know, obviously a startup, and then you kind of, and then you're growing, you're expanding, you get to steady state. Is there a stage where the I don't want to say imposition negatively, but when you install these principles, is there a stage of a company's life where you can best maximize how those principles can grow the value and the overall success of the company over another stage in that company's life cycle?
Well, John, when a company is small, it's important that the owners realize that to grow, we have to reinvest in the business. And most of the time, there is significant reinvestment. By the time a company gets to multi-millions or tens of millions or something like that, you can't grow quite that rapidly. And then it's time to become, and by the way, when you're growing, you're applying corporate finance principles because you're reinvesting, and you're reinvesting for growth. As growth opportunities diminish, whether that's at $5 million or $50 million or $500 million, then it's a good time to begin to look at dividend policy. If you look at corporate America, public corporate America, you'll find that a typical company might pay 40% of its earnings in dividends. They'll have a dividend policy that says we'll pay a third, we'll pay 40%, we'll pay a dividend yield or whatever that might be. But with many public companies, you will have, you're buying into an ongoing dividend stream, and that's part of the value of your investment. That's part of the value of your investment in a private company as well. So it's time, I think, for many private companies, the boards of directors of many private companies, to begin to focus on those basic issues. And the issues are we achieving a reasonable rate of return for the risks that we're taking for this private company that we're working with? Are we treating all of the shareholders reasonably in terms of their growth opportunities and their and our distribution opportunities?
So one last question for you, because what's really fascinating about everything we've talked about is it's all stemming from your valuation career, that you've now taken those principles and, again, kind of reverse engineered to apply them to help companies grow, you know, the value of what they're doing. Kind of in a big picture sense, what would you say to other practitioners, not even just in business valuation, but across all the valuation disciplines, about the idea of saying, look, you know, I've got this core skill set and I've developed it over a lifetime, but talk about for a moment, you know, branching out a little bit and taking those skills and applying them in kind of different and unique ways that still tie back in to having been an appraiser for a lifetime, but allows you, you know, we've been talking about growth this whole time. Appraisers have to continue to grow as well. And it sounds like for you, you found a very good growth opportunity. Talk about your experience and then what you'd say to your peers about, hey, don't be afraid to go out and take what you know and use it a little differently.
I have, over my career, had a number of niches, little niches that I have worked in. I started off valuing banks in the 90s. It was a tax-oriented world and developed the QMDM, or the Quantitative Marketability Discount Model, and basically I did tax for a number of years. I've done litigation, I've done statutory fair value, and today I'm doing applied corporate finance. But I've always tried to take the skills, the valuation skills that I have, and to focus on a productive niche where I'm not viewed as just another business valuation guy. You know, I think to people in the valuation business out there, I would focus on either a geographic niche and own it, or an industry niche and try to own that, because people talk about fee compression and that sort of thing. But if you're an expert, you know, you don't face fee compression at the same level that you do if you're not. And so my advice, I guess, would be to find a niche and fill it, but get good at something. Get very, very good at something where people will know that when they talk to you that you know something about this field.
Great. Well, Chris, I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me. It's been fascinating and enlightening. And with that, we've concluded this episode of Stories of Value, ASA's podcast looking at the human side of the appraisal profession. I've been your host, John Russell, and we look forward to speaking with you on a next episode. This episode of Stories of Value was brought to you by Barrowman Baker, LLC. With over 2 decades of experience, Barrowman Baker is here to help firms meet their business valuation staffing needs and to help individuals find that next opportunity. A nationally recognized leader in BV recruitment, Barrowman Baker, LLC.